This year, since Thanksgiving and Hanukkah coincide, on today's special edition of Food Fridays, we thought we would re-air a conversation I had in 2008 with Arthur Schwartz about Eastern European Jewish food. His book, Jewish Home Cooking, Yiddish Recipes Revisited, takes a fresh look at traditional cuisine and updates some old family recipes. We posted some of them on our show page at WNYC.org. I began by pointing out that Arthur is an expert on Italian food, and I asked him about his cooking school near Naples.
Just south, in the province of Salerno, near the Amalfi Coast. You're right. That is my main interest. However, this is the food of my youth, my heritage, my history. So one of these days I had to write this book, you know.
And you have written also about New York food. And,
yeah, you know.
And you make the point here that that New York food, when people talked about New York food in the past, they were largely talking about Jewish food.
They were. And actually, until in the 1950s, 25% of the New York City population was Jewish. One in four New Yorkers was Jewish. Now it's actually one in seven within the five boroughs. That's still a pretty big percentage. So, in fact, Jewish food mainstreamed, I would say, sometime just before World War II. And by the time the 50s came around, you could find Jewish food on any restaurant menu.
And you didn't have to be Jewish to know what a good pastrami sandwich tasted like or like bagels and lox.
No, not if you lived in New York. Even now, you know, the biggest critics of Jewish delicatessen are non-Jews who remember. No, actually, it's disappearing in New York. You know, there was a panel on this subject at the 92nd Street Y. I was unfortunately in Italy at the time, so I couldn't put my 2 cents in. But, in, I mean, the reason...
2 cents plain.
People keep asking me, you know, about this food because it is almost history. Lenny, when was the last time you had kasha varnishkas?
Well, not that long ago, but that's because I made them myself.
Ah, okay.
I love kasha.
I love kasha. You know, what could be more contemporary, I keep saying, than kasha varnishkas, pasta with whole grain and some onions for flavor. A lot of this food is actually a lot healthier and more contemporary than we think of.
So why has traditional Jewish cooking gotten this reputation for being less than healthy?
Well, for one reason, in my lifetime, this has stopped being everyday food. And now Jews make this food mainly for holidays, Rosh Hashanah, Passover, and then they make every recipe they know. Every recipe that's been handed down to them. And they get up from the table and say, oh, my God, it's so heavy. I'm dying.
And then a lot of it is made with animal fat.
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned schmaltz. You're getting to the point of schmaltz. Fact is, schmaltz is not as bad for you as some other fats, like butter. And here's a rule of thumb for life. If a fat is liquid at room temperature, it is largely or exclusively unsaturated fat. If it is solid at room temperature, it's largely exclusively saturated fat. That's the bad fat. Butter, even at a 72-degree overheated New York apartment, keeps its shape. Schmaltz is liquid.
So the goose fat is...
Goose's fat, duck fat, chicken fat are you know, let me say this. In my book, I use chicken fat as a flavor. I say as a condiment fat. It's like you drizzle a little bit of extra virgin olive oil over your bean soup to make it really taste Italian. And I use a little bit of chicken fat in my potato kugel to make it really taste like my grandmother's kugel, although better, I have to say. My grandmother was a great cook. A Jewish food editor said to me how disgusting when I told her what I was working on a few years ago. And, of course, she had her grandmother was a terrible cook. My grandmother, I had two grandmothers who were wonderful cooks, so I knew this food could be good.
Well, your grandmother, the one you're talking about, was born in this country, but her father...
Both of them were born, yeah.
Their parents were from the old country.
Right. My grandmother that I grew up with was born in Brownsville. Actually, I'm not clear if it's Brownsville or East New York, but off of Linden Boulevard along that way. By the way, my great-grandfather raised goats in Brooklyn. He had a dairy store. He sold goat milk. My grandmother grew up on goat milk. They didn't make goat cheese in those days, but you did have goat milk and goat yogurt. And even when I was growing up in the 1950s, there were still goats on Linden Boulevard. My other grandmother, whose father was a Hungarian, actually was born in Washington Heights. My 84-year-old cousin whispered to me recently. She says, you lie when you say she was from Brooklyn. She was born in Washington Heights. But yeah, two New York-born grandparents, one of whom did not cook at all until she got married. My grandfather, my Schwartz was a chef. So he taught my grandmother how to cook. My other grandmother learned from her mother, and she just loved to do it.
Now, we're talking about the food of Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe. But there's a lot of different countries here. Poland,
yes.
Russia, Lithuania, Latvia, Germany, Austria, Hungary, Romania. How regional does the food wind up?
Very regional. In fact, even South Poland and North Poland had different food ways. And so, yeah, it's all been, you know, I have to say, this is really Yiddish-American food. This is what happened when all those people met on the Lower East Side and in Brownsville and East New York, and it basically came up with a new American style of that cuisine.
In the same way that we have Italian-American food, Chinese-American food.
Right. This is Jewish-American. And by the way, Italian-American, which I know quite a bit about, is also like this. It's an amalgam of various regional cuisines, because I'm writing a book right now on the cuisines of southern Italy. It's six regions here. And the food of Sicily is really quite different than the food of, say, Campania around Naples. But when it came here to the U.S., these people lived next door to each other, and they shared recipes, and it became all one.
And also in Europe, you were relying on local ingredients.
Correct.
In New York, you were relying on whatever came into the city
areas. All cuisines, all...
Except those old goats that were on Linden Boulevard.
All national cuisines, I want to call them national cuisines, become ethnic cuisines when they get to the U.S. And they all go through what I call the immigrant experience, which is they become more meat-heavy, because in the old country, no matter what country that was, they didn't have much meat. You come to the U.S., we were built on the cattle industry, so meat was cheap. In fact, on the Lower East Side, before the Italians started coming in the 1870s and 1880s, the places you met, the food store you met in, was the butcher shop downtown. There were no vegetables being sold in the neighborhoods. In order to get a vegetable or fruit, you had to go to either the Far East Side or the Far West Side, where there were the major markets, like the Washington Market. And that's where you had to buy fruit and vegetables. Only when the Italians came and they discovered there was no fruit and vegetables around the corner did they start bringing the fruit and vegetables to their corner and started selling them. That's how they became big in the produce industry. And they continued that for 100 years until the 1970s. When another immigrant group came along, the Koreans, and changed that whole business.
My guest is Arthur Schwartz, whose latest book is called Jewish Home Cooking, Yiddish Recipes Revisited, published by 10 Speed Press, with lots of pictures. And some of these pictures are of things I recognize. Some of them are not. You admit that some of the recipes can feel dated and that the food comes from a time before elliptical machines and treadmills were around.
Right.
So they were made differently?
Yes. The food was heavier, admittedly. But I, you know, the thing is, Len, I was cooking this food for a year as an everyday food. And I realized, add broccoli and you've got a good three-course American meal. I mean, let's say flanken. Let's just use that as an example because it's a very popular cut of meat. It's really short ribs cut in the opposite direction. I'm sorry. Daniel Ballou charges $52 for one little short rib. Let's not make fun of my grandmother's flanken. It's a wonderful everyday dish. You can make it sweet and sour. You can make it potted. You can just broil it. It's delicious.
But interestingly, in updating these things, you in some ways return to older traditions. For example, you use fresh vegetables to make the vegetable cutlets that were a specialty of the Jewish dairy restaurants like Ratner's. They used to use canned
That's
vegetables.
Right. I have the Ratner's cookbook. And everything was out of a can. And, you know, it wasn't just...
No wonder they closed.
Yes. It wasn't just the Jewish restaurants that did that, by the way. There's a very funny story in my last book in Arthur Schwartz's New York City Food. Andre Saltner tells the story. When he came to New York in the early 60s, and his mandate from James Beard and Andre Sermin, who were the people who hired him to open Lutèce restaurant, their mandate was that he only use fresh vegetables. Well, one of the big dishes in New York at the time was veal scallops with girolles, a kind of wild mushroom. There were no fresh girolles in New York. They all came out of cans. And he was not supposed to use anything out of a can, so that dish he didn't serve. years go by. It's now the 1980s, and he is offered by a salesman a fresh girolle. And he says to them, well, where did these come from? They had to be here before now. Oh, they're coming from Michigan. So he called the guy who gathers them in Michigan. He said, you know, where were these all these years? He said, I used to sell them to the Germans. They'd put them in cans and then export them to the U.S. So they were American. We had all these things. We just didn't know how to use them. Another example where I use fresh and not canned is vegetarian chopped liver, one of my favorite recipes in the book. I use fresh string beans. Yes, you have to cook them until they're very soft, not like a canned string bean, but you still want some fresh flavor out of them. But it doesn't work if you don't cook them for a long time. But Grandma used to make that with canned string beans or canned peas. And I just changed it to a fresh vegetable. It does have a fresher, better taste.
What do you want to call this food? Yiddish food or Jewish-American food?
Well, it's not Jewish-American because there is no such thing as Jewish food. Jews eat the food of wherever, whatever culture they live in.
Except they use the kosher ingredients.
Exactly. Except that we have to abide by kosher dietary laws. Now, if a kosher Martian landed in New York City today, he would think that the most Jewish food was sushi and pizza, because this is what contemporary Orthodox Jewish people are eating today. You can eat, there's a Neapolitan pizza pasta place in Brooklyn, kosher, glatt kosher. Well, not glatt, it's Chol of Yisrael because it's a dairy restaurant. The last page of the menu, they have sushi. They have a sushi chef in the Neapolitan pasta pizza place. So it's replaced gefilte fish as the appetizer of choice in the steakhouses.
So is the traditional, are the traditional recipes going to disappear? Or
I'm hoping not. I hope I put them down here so that they won't.
Yeah, but this could be a museum collection
No, but it's not, though, because the food is delicious.
Orthodox Jews are still making most of these dishes.
You know, Orthodox Jews are making very contemporary food. If you look at what's selling in the bookstores to the Orthodox, it's a series of books called Kosher by Design, which is all very contemporary international/American food that is kosher. Very few people, except at holidays, as I said, are making the old-fashioned Yiddish food. And it's, you know what? We honor other people's poor people food. We love Chinese poor people food. We love Italian poor people food. Why don't we look at our own food and see that we have really a wonderful cuisine?
Well, there was a time when you could buy all of the ingredients or buy prepared foods pretty much everywhere. When I was growing up in Williamsburg, there must have been 10 competing bakeries that
right.
We would go to one, just get the babka. We'd go another one for the seeded rye, another one for the cornbread, because we knew that they had the best cornbread.
You had now, my mother.
I had my mother. Yes. My mother said, go to Singer's. They have the best cornbread.
Right. That's a dying item.
Yeah, and you can't find cornbread
anymore.
Yes, you
can. At Corn's Bakery on 16th Avenue, In Borough Park, they have a pretty good cornbread.
Well, in the old days, Singers, you cut it and the thing kind of fell off in layers. It was the most gorgeous stuff you ever saw. It gave you a heartburn for 2 weeks, but it was delicious.
Now,
with
why
sweet
did it
butter.
Give you heartburn for 2 weeks? Now, this is a
because it was so I don't know. It was just,
no, it's because you gobbled it down.
Yeah, I ate a big slice because it was so delicious. But you don't find these places anymore.
Yeah, you do, Lenny. I got to give you a tour. We both live
aren't
in,
they? Are they all in Brooklyn these
yes,
days?
Yes, they are. They're
what happened to Manhattan? Did all is it because
they're
only there?
There are very. The rents are too high, for one thing, for a neighborhood bakery. You know, it's got to be a huge, huge moneymaker for to afford the rent in Manhattan. I would say that Brooklyn is unquestionably the Yiddish food heartland. And we have several kosher neighborhoods that you can shop in. The biggest and best is certainly 13th Avenue in Borough Park. But also Avenue J, is a modern Orthodox shopping street, has some wonderful, wonderful stores, as several bakeries, as you describe. Avenue M is more Sephardic, the Syrian Jewish community of Midwood. Also King's Highway. Interestingly, there's a wonderful kosher pita bakery on King's Highway in Brooklyn. I think it's about 4th Street, East 4th Street. Now the name is failing me. But they also make the best chocolate babka. And I asked the owner, how do you come? You know, you're a Middle Eastern guy. How do you come to chocolate babka? He says, the neighborhood wants me to make chocolate babka. So he really makes it great.
And Lee Avenue in Williamsburg?
You know, it's hard. No. You know, there are Satmar stores. Now, the Satmar Hasidim are an interesting community. They're originally from Hungary, and they're young people. Of course, they've listened to biblical dictums, and they have been fruitful, and they have multiplied. And a lot of their young people are going into the food business. They're opening bakeries. There's a wonderful Satmar butcher shop on Avenue J in Brooklyn. And they have catering places, and they're introducing some of the old Hungarian items that we haven't seen in New York in a long time, like shlishkis, which are exactly the same as potato gnocchi, except that you saute them in breadcrumbs.
It is interesting how different cultures come up with the same idea. I mean, the dumpling is everywhere, almost throughout the world, and things like gnocchi.
I have to say, gnocchi and shlishkis come out of the same Austro-Hungarian culture. My grandmother, who was more Hungarian than anything else, made shlishkis. And, of course, her family was right on the border of Italy, what we now call Italy. It wasn't Italy then. It was still the Austrian Empire.
We have to take a little break right now. My guest is Arthur Schwartz. His latest book is Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking, Yiddish Recipes Revisited, published by 10 Speed Press, with lots of beautiful pictures, and we will continue after this. We're back with an interview I did in 2008 with Arthur Schwartz, who's a food writer, editor, and cooking teacher. The New York Times Magazine has called him a walking Google of food and restaurant knowledge. We were discussing his book, Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking, Yiddish Recipes Revisited, which is based on his own experiences and his research. We posted some recipes from the book on our show page at WNYC.org. I mentioned that it's getting harder and harder to find the really good stuff. Are the places that have survived, like Barney Greengrass and Russ and Daughters, the best, or are they simply the ones who figured out how to keep going?
Russ and Daughters, I don't really know much about Barney Greengrass, but I know about Russ and Daughters because Mark Fetterman, who I think is your friend as well, and I know the story. And in fact, Russ and Daughters was in serious decline when Mark took it over. Mark had another career entirely.
He was a lawyer.
He was a lawyer, right. I try not to mention that because I like him too much. But anyway, Mark saw that, you know, this was a dying form of store in New York, what we call the appetizing store, that specialized in all the dairy items. Now, here's where Kashrut comes in. A delicatessen, properly, is a place where you buy meat and the things that go with meat. And an appetizing store is a store where you buy smoked and pickled fish, cheeses, and the things that go with those items as part of that meal, which would also include things like dried fruit for some reason and nuts and pickles. They often sell in appetizing stores. Well, it's a part of the pickle thing. So Mark saw an opportunity, and he is the grandson of Russ. His mother was one of the daughters. His mother is one of the daughters. His mother and his aunt are still alive. Two of the three Russ daughters are still alive, living in Florida. And Mark took an opportunity. I think Barney Greengrass survives pretty much the way it always has because the Upper West Side, it's on Amsterdam and 82nd Street, I think, that has always remained a middle-class Jewish neighborhood, or with at least a large middle-class Jewish following.
But I don't understand why there aren't a lot of appetizing stores around town. There used to be.
I don't know.
People still eat lox.
I know.
They still
actually,
have bagels.
Let me clarify that. It's interesting about real lox, which is salt-cured salmon, is seriously declining. Only about 15% of the cured salmon that's sold is lox.
That's because belly lox is so salty.
85% is now smoked salmon. It's different. You know, I agree with you. I'm not sure why that happened. But what I know happened is that bagel bakeries took over the sale of those items that went with the bagels. Interestingly, those items did not go with bagels until the 1930s or maybe even 1940s. Until the 30s or 40s, lox, smoked fish, herring, all that you ate with sourdough rye bread, which we call cornbread, or black bread or pumpernickel, those old European breads. Bagels were sold separately. And I only know this from Mark Fetterman's mother, who told me that they didn't sell bagels at Russ and Daughters until the 1940s when customers started to demand it.
But then pastrami is another favorite of New Yorkers in general, and yet today Katz's Delicatessen may be the only place you can get the kind of pastrami that was everywhere when I was a kid.
It's true. Absolutely.
There was at least six pastrami kings and pastrami queens in my neighborhood when I was growing up.
Right. I don't know where you went in Williamsburg, but I remember very, very fondly, actually a place that's still there, Edelman's on King's Highway. But we used to go to Grabstein's and Canarsie on Ralph Avenue, I think that was. And then there was a wonderful delicatessen across from the King's Movie Theater on Flatbush Avenue that I used to go to after the movies. No, they're all gone. And I think the real reason is people do have an impression that this food is extremely unhealthy. And so you only treat yourself to a pastrami sandwich once in a while. I know I do only once in a while. Who can, forget the health aspect, the calories, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, these
sandwiches. And now they make
and
them.
Exactly what I was going to say. They make them like for a family of four.
I don't know. I think that's just piling it on so that they can charge you more. I would prefer a nice, modest pastrami or corned beef sandwich. And
well, you know, you know where you should go? Edelman's is in your old neighborhood in Williamsburg. It's a very, very glot delicatessen. And I laugh when I go there because they have your normal pastrami sandwich and your ungestuppt, meaning you're overstuffed. But by them, an overstuffed sandwich is eight slices of meat instead of four. You know, it's not that big.
Although I've always been amused by people saying, I want a lean pastrami sandwich. The whole idea of a pastrami sandwich is that it should be
right.
Juicy.
It should be juicy is the word, by the way. Your listeners should know that they have to ask for juicy. You don't say, I want a fatty pastrami. I want a juicy pastrami.
Now, our listeners are sending in things. One says that the new Second Avenue Deli in Murray Hill has the best corned beef sandwich in New York.
Can I put my two cents in here?
Of course.
I've been to the new Second Avenue Deli. I have to agree that the pastrami and the corned beef are much improved over the old Second Avenue Deli, but I'm not putting up with the whole scene to get it.
And somebody else says Kosar's Bialy's also sells the best bagels. Somebody else says the best bagels come from Bagel Oasis in Queens.
No, the best bagels are from a place I'm not going to. Can I tell you the name? Oh, yeah, the Bagel Hole on 7th Avenue and 12th Street in Park Slope. I think those are the best bagels around.
Now,
Phil Romanzi, by the way, is the owner and who makes every bagel you eat is an Italian-American guy.
Now, these are the kinds of bagels I remember from my youth. Although there have been concessions, there are raisins and things like that, never have been considered kosher in the old days. But still, they are not these huge puffy things. What happened? How did
Americans don't
puffy?
Like to chew. I think that's the bottom line here. After all, New York is made up of a lot of people from other places. We are lucky, Leonard. We both grew up in Brooklyn. We know the real deal. We know what's good. And but people who were from Ohio originally, they want a big, puffy – they want white bread in a ring with a little crust. Actually, the reason that the Bagel Hole's bagels taste so good – there are a lot of reasons. But one is the size. And it's not just the size. It's the fact that there's more – higher ratio of crust to inside. And this was a revelation I had a number of years ago at a bagel bakery on Flatbush Avenue. Sadly – was sold and they're not making the good bagels anymore. But this guy used to make old-fashioned bagels, but in order to sell them, he had to call them mini bagels. Because to sell a little bagel like that, people thought they were getting cheated. So as mini bagels, they tasted like old-fashioned bagels.
The standard for Bialy's has been Kosar's on Grand Street for many years, but that's not as good as it used to be either. The original owner sold it.
Nothing is as good as it used to be.
Why?
You know, I don't need to tell you. You're a very, very smart, well-read, well-viewed person. Can I quote the scene from Atlantic City? You know,
Who am I, Susan Sarandon or Burt Lancaster?
No, Burt Lancaster's walking down the boardwalk with this young punk, and the punk is saying, and he's saying to the punk, this was better in the old days, that was better in the old days, and the kid finally says to him, but now you still have the ocean. And Burt Lancaster says, you should have seen it then. Nothing is the same, and never will be.
My guest is Arthur Schwartz, who'll always be great. His latest book is Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking, Yiddish Recipes Revisited from 10 Speed Press. You have a chapter on the Jewish relationship with Chinese food, why Jews like Chinese food.
Yeah. Do you like Chinese food?
Yeah, sure. Well, I used to live in Chinatown.
I forgot. How could I forget?
But the kind of Chinese food I liked is not the kind we're talking about.
It's hard to find good Chinese food these days.
Is it?
I mean, you have to go to a Chinatown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but don't you think that that applies to all kinds of ethnic cuisines? You have to have a knowledgeable public to keep the standards.
Absolutely.
And so the Chinatowns draw Chinese people who then will not settle for anything other than the real thing.
Right.
And where there are Jewish neighborhoods, there will be the same kinds of standards. Where there are Italian
We have great, I must say, and I'm going to give you a little personal tour. We have some great old-fashioned Jewish bakeries in Brooklyn. So, yes, Jews are in love with Chinese food, and a lot of reasons. Let's start with the proximity to it. We all lived together, meaning Jews, Italians, Irish, and Chinese. We all lived together on the Lower East Side when we first arrived in this country within the same 30-year period. We all graduated to the American dream in the boroughs about the same time, the 1920s. In 1925 or 26, Brooklyn had the most housing starts of any municipality in America. And who moved there with those four ethnic groups? The Chinese, of course, opened laundries and restaurants. That was the way they earned their living, but they were my neighbors in Brooklyn. And so when you went out to eat, where did you go? You had a choice, Jewish delicatessen. There weren't that many choices. An Italian neighborhood restaurant, Southern Italian restaurant, an Italian-American, or Chinese. Jews, although we loved Italian food, it did combine dairy and meat on the same plate. And there might have been a crucifix, a Madonna, or a Jesus over the cash register. Very intimidating to a Jew. The delicatessens we were all too familiar with, it wasn't a treat to go out to a delicatessen. So that left us with Chinese food, which we could afford. So that's the number two. Chinese food was very cheap. We were all upwardly mobile. We weren't upward yet. Three, they didn't combine dairy and meat together. There's almost no dairy, or is no dairy, in old-fashioned Cantonese cooking is what we got. And also, the Chinese were even lower on the social ladder than Jews. So you could go to a Chinese restaurant, and you were just another white guy to the Chinese.
Which is what Philip Roth wrote in Portnoy's Complaint.
Yes, right. By the way, I have to tell you this. I can say this on the air. I quoted Portnoy's Complaint in two different books that got cut out by my editors, telling me that it was too offensive, what Portnoy said about. I had that whole long passage about eating in a Chinese restaurant and from Portnoy's Complaint. Two editors cut it out of my New York book and the Jewish book.
And now there are kosher Chinese restaurants
New
York. And
the pork is, and the treif, meaning the forbidden food, is often hidden. I had a cousin Danny who was totally kosher, but at home he would eat Chinese roast pork fried rice. I once said to him, Danny, how come you'll eat this? It's got pork. And he says, oh, they cut it up so small I can't tell.
If you had a religious guest coming to your house, what would you cook from this cookbook?
Vegetarian. I mean, I have had kosher people who will eat in my home, and that's already a compromise for a lot of kosher people because I don't have a kosher home. But I would make a vegetarian meal. I would make the vegetarian chopped liver. I might make some of the salads that are very good. Egg dishes I could make.
And if you wanted to show off for non-Jewish friends?
I have. I've done that too. I make egg barley with wild mushrooms, a casserole dish. I've served that to Italian friends. They think it's as good as any Italian pasta. I often make beef cheeks, an exotic cut of meat. Listen, Mario Batali made his whole career serving cheek meat. He's got nothing over the Lubavitch women of Crown Heights.
So he does pork cheeks and
I do beef cheeks. Potted beef cheeks or sweet and sour beef cheeks. If you called chullant cassoulet, it would be a big item on restaurant menus. I could make them a chullant too.
And do you have something that you would just cook that you've been cooking over the years?
I must say I make an awful lot of that vegetarian chopped liver, so much that a nutritionist friend of mine did a nutritional breakdown. We found that it's only 60 calories in a quarter of a cup of my vegetarian chopped liver. So you could really eat quite a lot of that. I make sweet and sour flanken and sweet and sour meatballs quite a lot. And I must say there's some baking in this book. I'm not a huge baker, but there's some baking in this book that I do a lot of. The babka, the chocolate babka, is sensational.
You've included a glossary of Yiddish food terms in the back of your book. Are these terms that most New Yorkers would recognize?
I think most, not all necessarily. I have to say, that was the most fun writing this book, and you're the first person to mention it. I don't think most people get to the back of the book. Leonard reads every word. I worked a lot on this, and let's see. Here's one word that I had so much fun learning about, Farfel. Mm-hmm. I actually now, Leonard.
Matzah Farfel was something.
Well, that's the one
with.
That, you know, it's funny. I was doing cooking demos, and in some of these places I went to, they did the prep for me. And I'd get there, and they would only have matzah farfel to do my mushroom, egg, barley, and wild mushroom thing. Anyway, there are many kinds of farfel, but the word farfel comes from the Yiddish word farfallen, which means to fall away. Do you speak Yiddish?
I knew that word. I don't speak Yiddish.
And the original farfel was made with a very stiff, by the way, another overlap with Austrian cooking and Italian cooking, a very stiff egg dough that was grated on a grater until it fell away in little pieces. Hence, we now call it egg barley because it's a kind of pasta, and the Mothers, which is the main manufacturer, decided to call it egg barley. The other kind of farfel was egg noodle dough that was chopped in a bowl with a Hochtmesser, one of those old-fashioned choppers in a wooden bowl, until it fell into little pieces.
This is a curved bowl with this thing of the handle.
Yes, I have.
We had it at my house.
You can buy new ones. Now, the old ones don't work so well. I have my grandmother's and my mother's. But from the Vermont country store, they sell a brand new Hochtmesser with a real good blade. It's very nice. I bought one. It's like $10.
I'm amazed OXO hasn't gotten into that.
With a rubber handle.
Yeah. The apple cake recipe in your book has been reproduced in several publications. Is that a favorite of yours?
There are two apple cakes in the book. One's a Passover apple cake, which I love, even not when
and
not
that's
Passover.
That's made with regular flour.
That's made with cake meal. Yeah, mm-hmm. with very, very fine ground up matzah. And the other one is a recipe that I've had in my collection for my repertoire for over 30 years. It was given to me as a German apple cake, but interestingly, in the bakeries of Brooklyn, they sell it as Hungarian apple cake. It's a delicious apple cake, lots and lots of apples, cinnamon, and walnuts. What could be bad? It's very hard to find this food, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book. Blintzes happen to be an extremely easy thing to make. If you know how to make a crepe, you can make a blintz. And if you don't know how to make a crepe, it'll take you 5 minutes to learn. And that's something you can do any day of the week. That's a great dish to serve a vegetarian.
And you have some step-by-step illustrations
yes.
here as well.
Yeah, we do.
For the more difficult things to make. Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking, Yiddish Recipes Revisited, is published by 10 Speed Press. And Arthur, thank you so much for coming by
and talking about
this. It's been like a trip down memory lane for me. Up next, my 2008 conversation with the late Marcella Hazan and her husband, Victor. They were here to talk about her memoir, Amarcord. And then later on, we'll hear from another beloved figure from the food world who died this fall, Chef Charlie Trotter. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter.